is the news.
Russia says Ukraine's reaction to the car blast at the Crimean bridge that killed three people shows its terrorist nature. Israeli forces once again raided the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank, killing two Palestinians and injuring nearly a dozen. Also ahead, Iran says the link between acts of violence against its diplomatic missions in Europe and the West's support for rioters in the country is undeniable. Welcome to World, the news from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Now, top story this hour, a blaze sparked by a car bomb blast has hit a key bridge linking the Crimean Peninsula to mainland Russia. Moscow says it's investigating the incident.
The main investigation department of the Russian Investigative Committee has opened a criminal case about the incident at the Crimean Bridge. According to preliminary information, a truck was blown up on the automobile part of the Crimean Bridge from the Taman Peninsula. This led to the ignition of seven fuel tanks of a train traveling toward Crimea, and as a result, two car roads of the bridge partially collapsed.
Russian investigators say at least three people have been killed as a result. They also say the owner of the truck has been identified. There has been no immediate claim of responsibility, but the chairman of the Crimean Republic State Council has blamed what he called Ukrainian vandals. Meanwhile, a Ukrainian presidential advisor has said the explosion is the beginning and that everything illegal must be destroyed. Russia has reacted to that, saying the comments show what it called the terrorist nature of Ukraine. The bridge was opened in 2018, 4 years after Crimea joined Russia. It now serves as a key transport link for carrying military equipment to Russian soldiers fighting in Ukraine. Our correspondent Johnny Miller in Donetsk says Russia is likely to avenge the Crimean bridge blast by hitting more targets in Ukraine.
Russian officials are pointing the blame at Ukraine. One member of the Russian parliament says that this is not only a challenge by Ukraine, it is a declaration of war, or I quote, a war without rules. So what does that mean? We can expect a massive response now from Russia. For months now, we've been expecting Russia to escalate, start attacking other targets within Ukraine. From the beginning of this conflict, they focused on military targets, headquarters, barracks, weapon supplies, and many Western analysts have been confused as to why Russia hasn't launched strikes against civil infrastructure. Of course, when the Americans invaded Iraq, of course, they started hitting Baghdad from the very start. Many are confused why Russia hasn't done this yet. We've been expecting a kind of red line, if you want, to be crossed by Ukraine over recent months, perhaps when Ukraine attacked Belgorod or Rostov in the Russian Federation, or when they started attacking Crimea. But this attack on the Crimean bridge, it looks like it'll be a major point in this war, as we expect Russia to strike back with a huge amount of force. They may well hit power stations, bridges, civil infrastructure. We've been expecting that for weeks now, especially as Russia has mobilized over 300,000 men who are slowly coming into the Donbass region. So this attack on this bridge, all the fingers are being pointed at Ukraine. This attack on this bridge looks to be a major moment in this conflict.
The Indian Minister of Petroleum and Natural Gas says New Delhi will buy oil from any country it deems necessary. Hardeep Singh Puri says the Indian government has a duty to provide its citizens with energy and will get it from wherever it has to. He says India has not been told by anyone to stop purchasing oil from Russia. The Indian official says energy security requires that governments buy from wherever necessary. His comments come as the West is cutting down on its energy purchases from Russia. Western states are doing so in line with their sanctions and restrictions on Russia over the war in Ukraine. Manawar Zaman in New Delhi says the comments by the Indian oil minister shows that the country puts national interests before anything else.
India has reaffirmed time and again that it will take public interest, the country's interest, into consideration first before deciding on the foreign policies and many other issues related to economy. And it is a very good step, and it's a positive step in the right direction that India has taken, and many in the past as well. Now, Russia, which is already facing sanctions from Western countries, has worked a mechanism to deal with imports and rest of the economic activities, and I'm sure India is preparing such footprints, India is preparing such kind of program or any sort of way to deal with the sanctions and continue Iranian oil imports, because as we know, India and Iran has been a major energy partner since decades, and Indian refiners are also, they are customized in a way that it becomes easy for them to use Iranian crude oil imports.
Israeli forces have killed two more Palestinians in the occupied West Bank after they attacked the Jenin refugee camp. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 11 others were also injured in the raid. That brings to four the number of Palestinians, including two teenagers, killed by regime forces over the past 24 hours. Palestinian security sources say undercover Israeli forces sneaked into the Jenin camp. Later, dozens of armored vehicles stormed the camp from multiple directions. Troops also reportedly fired towards the journalists covering the raid. The Jenin refugee camp has been the focal point of an Israeli crackdown that has intensified in recent months. More than 100 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli attacks across the occupied territories so far this year. Earlier, our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, joined us with the late details on the Israeli brutalities in the occupied West Bank.
Yesterday, the Israeli forces killed two Palestinians in separate incidents in Qalqilia and in Al-Mazra' al-Gharbiya near Ramallah. Today, the Israeli forces raided again the Jenin refugee camp. According to the Israeli military, the operation aimed to arrest a Palestinian accused by the Israeli military for being wanted for security reasons. They surrounded a house in the Jenin refugee camp. Of course, confrontations took place between Palestinian fighters and Palestinian residents of the refugee camp and the Israeli forces. The Israeli troops shot dead two Palestinians and wounded at least 11 others. According to Palestinian paramedics, three of those who were wounded are in serious condition. Today, during the operation, the Jenin refugee camp received that at least four Palestinian journalists had been surrounded by the Israeli forces raiding the refugee camp, and they were throwing heavy tear gas and stun grenades.
A mass rally has been held in the Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the establishment of the Islamic Jihad movement, the movement that refuses to recognize the Israeli regime while maintaining armed resistance as the only way to liberate Palestine. Ashraf Shannon reports.
Thousands of Palestinians have rallied in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the 35th anniversary of the outset of the Islamic Jihad movement. People from all walks of life joined to show their support. The Islamic Jihad movement is highly respected by all Palestinian factions and has always been a uniting factor among them. The movement was founded by the late Dr. Fathi Shaqaqi, who was inspired by the Iranian Revolution and the teachings of the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini.
Today we pay tribute to our founder Fathi Shaqaqi and all the martyrs. Our path is a very long one and paved by the blood of martyrs who sacrificed their lives for the sake of Islam and for the sake of Al-Quds.
Ziad Al-Nakhala, the Secretary General of Islamic Jihad, addressed the attendees via satellite link. During his speech, Al-Nakhala stressed the unity among all Palestinian factions and praised the axis of resistance against the Israeli regime.
Gaza is part of the axis of resistance, and this rally stresses that armed resistance is the key to the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. People attending this event are affirming their allegiance to the resistance and to the Islamic Jihad movement.
The Islamic Jihad movement and its leaders remain blacklisted by the European Union and the United States for refusing to recognize the Israeli regime. Islamic Jihad supporters want the Israeli regime to know that their movement is a force to be reckoned with. 35 years on, the popularity of the Islamic Jihad movement continues to grow due to the movement's strict adherence to armed resistance against the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Tehran has summoned the Danish ambassador over an attack by a knife-wielding assailant on the Iranian embassy in Copenhagen. The foreign ministry says it lodged a strong protest with the ambassador over Denmark's failure to protect the embassy and its diplomats. Meanwhile, the foreign ministry spokesman Nazar Kanani has cited the attack and the other incidents at Iranian diplomatic missions in Europe over the past weeks. He says the link between such acts of violence and the West's political support for rioters in Iran is undeniable. On Friday morning, an assailant broke into the Iranian embassy in Copenhagen. He tried to stab the ambassador, but he was stopped by a staffer. The assailant injured the staffer and damaged the vehicles in the parking lot before being arrested by the Danish police. The Iranian Foreign Ministry, meanwhile, spokesman, has called unacceptable a resolution passed by the European Parliament over the recent unrest in the country. Nasser Kanani said the resolution bears no value as it amounts to interfering in Iran's internal affairs. He said the European Parliament has adopted a double standard approach with its resolution, reflecting prejudgments toward Iran. The resolution called for EU sanctions against Iranian officials over alleged human rights violations and a crackdown against protests. The demonstrations broke out in a number of Iranian cities in mid-September after the death of young woman Mahsa Amini. The rallies then turned into violent riots, which Iran blamed on foreign elements. On Friday, Iran released an official forensic report into Amini's death. It said she died due to multiple organ failure caused by a cerebral hypoxia, not beatings. The aftermath of anti-Iran violence in London continues to be keenly felt by the institutions and individuals who found themselves at its epicenter. One of the most shocking episodes of mindless violence occurred outside the famed Islamic Center, where worshippers had gathered to mark a special religious program. As the Metropolitan Police continued to search for the perpetrators, Amina Taylor spoke with two people at the very heart of the story.
It was the night chaos and violence came to England's Islamic Center, as marauding crowds, intent on raising more than their voices, lay siege to the usually peaceful premises. More than a week later, there is still evidence of the violence that boiled over. Amongst the victims that night was a longtime Quran teacher at the center, who was set upon by a baying mob.
Suddenly the people, so many people were there standing, started calling me and swearing, and shouting, stay, and surrounded me. And the other people came, starting hitting me, kicking me, and swearing, just without stopping. And I couldn't understand. I was so surprised from them. So how can the people become this violent? One of them, he kicked me from the over my my kidney. And I still have a problem with my kidney. I went to the hospital, so the doctor, and So my knee as well, so just had very big scratch in my knees and bloating. I still have problems with my leg, right leg. I can't walk properly after this 10 days, more than 10 days.
Said Mousavi is the director of the center and is leading the charge for justice.
The Islamic Center is following its legal path, and a case against the riots has been filed, and it is ongoing based on document and evidence.
Days after violence rocked the Islamic Center, behind me there is still a visible police presence. And whilst those inside do everything they can to protect themselves and their loved ones, it's hoped that should there be a repeat of this atrocity, the authorities will do more.
Until those responsible are brought to account, there are still questions.
But why they did that in that time, I was so surprised. I think it wasn't only one group. I think it was very small groups of the people who were against Islam and against the humanity, and against their kindness, against... I think they were like this, some of them.
There is now a call for calm and dialogue as the only paths forward.
If you want people listen to you and respect your idea, you should respect the idea of the other as well. That is why I want to ask them, please come and talk and have a dialogue with each other. And then with the dialogue, we can listen to different ideas. And of course, even in Quran, we have a specific advice that tells us you should listen to different words and choose the best. But different word, not different attack.
Meanwhile, the Metropolitan Police is continuing its identification of individuals responsible for the anti-Iran violence that spilled over on British streets. Amina Taylor, London.
Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Virtues of the Believers, Friday the 3rd of Ramadan, 1394, the 20th of September, 1974. Another example of anfal is mineral wealth, ma'adin, that is extracted from beneath the ground. Yet another example is the forests, the deserts, or the great pastures in valleys or on mountains. In short, anfal denotes any kind of wealth that does not belong to a single person or to a single group of people, but rather is public property, belonging to the nation as a collective. However, one of the aforementioned examples are those spoils won by soldiers in warfare. The first time this question seems to have been raised was after the Battle of Badr, when the Muslims were discussing how they should divide the spoils they had won. They disagreed with one another, so they referred the matter to the Prophet and asked him what they should do. Their answer came in the form of the aforementioned verse of the Quran, Say, the Anfal belong to Allah and the Apostle. What does it mean when the Quran says they belong to Allah? It means that they do not belong to any one particular group of people. Anything that belongs to Allah, anything that is said to be God's property, actually means something that should be used for godly aims.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Clearly, when we say that something belongs to God, we do not mean that it should be spent for God's benefit, because God does not benefit from wealth. God does not have any needs. God does not have any wants. So there is no need to spend His wealth to fulfill these. On the contrary, when we speak of God's property, we mean the property of all of His servants. Therefore, His wealth should be used for those causes alone which God has specified. This is the meaning of saying something belongs to Allah. And the Apostle, what does this mean? That it is the property of the Messenger. Yes, but what does that mean? Is the Prophet the polar opposite of God? Of course not. But when we say something belongs to Allah, someone might come along and give himself the right to do with it as he pleases, because it belongs to no one in particular. He can say, this belongs to Allah, and we are all Allah's servants. So using this pleasant-sounding and attractive slogan, the person can use something that belongs to everyone for his own personal benefit. Therefore, while Allah's wealth is supposed to be used for the benefit of all the Muslims and all of God's true servants, using it for the public good does not mean it can be used haphazardly, as anyone pleases. On the contrary, there should be some management of this wealth. There should be someone in charge of it as God's representative, who will look after people's interests.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Fighting has erupted again in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region, ending hopes for peace after a ceasefire declared in March ended in tatters. Many Ethiopians believe Western powers are backing Tigray rebels who restarted the war. Ethiopians have held protests across the world, calling on Washington to stop its support for TPLF rebels.
It is very critical. It's an issue of the country. And we don't need America to interfere in Ethiopians' issue. Actually, we don't need any support. America must stay away. USA must stay away from the issue of Ethiopia. Because of them, we are suffering now. Our country is getting finished. People are dying, and our economy is getting finished. Therefore, it's because of America. America must stop. America must raise his hand, pick his hand back, and America must stay away. It's because of them, they entered in our country, interfering, causing problems, causing fighting. No, because of them, we are suffering. Therefore, wherever we live, America is supporting TPLF.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of news and events making headlines in Africa. Today we are focusing on renewed fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region amid reports that some Western powers are supporting the rebels in this Horn of Africa nation. We are asking, why are foreign powers and some regional countries backing the rebels in Ethiopia? The second part of our show today will be on the move by the European Parliament to oppose the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline, a move that has angered the people of Uganda. Stay with us as our experts give us their incisive analysis on today's subjects. You can also be part of the conversation by sending your comments through our social media handle.
Western powers backing Ethiopia rebels. The people of Ethiopia are once again witnessing renewed fighting between government forces and Tigray People's Liberation Front, or the TPLF rebels. Fighting erupted late August, shattering a five-month truce aimed at ending the 21-month conflict in Africa's second most populous nation. The TPLF ruled Ethiopia for 27 years before it ousted in 2018 following anti-government protests across the country. Abiy Ahmed took over as prime minister after the ouster of the TPLF. Now, Abiy's government accuses the TPLF of attempting to reassert Tigrayan dominance over Ethiopia.
Foreign powers that backed TPLF during its rule over Ethiopia have been accused of supporting this party, which is now a rebel group. During a rally to denounce foreign backers of TPLF rebels, the mayor of Addis Ababa vowed that the rebels will never succeed.
After a sacrifice paid, those people of ours have left us the freedom you're enjoying today. We can never have a drop of patience to tolerate those who attempt to take that freedom away from us. The TPLF junta, the terrorist group, has waged war on us at the time when we started a new era, forgetting the atrocities and crimes it has committed over the last 27 years. They will never succeed.
But for more on the current situation in Ethiopia, we contacted Yolian Ogbu, an independent political writer and commentator. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Western countries have been accused of backing Tigray rebels in northern Ethiopia. If that is the case, what is the objective of Western powers in destabilizing Ethiopia?
TPLF has had a long-standing relationship with the West. For about 30 years, from 1991 to 2018, TPLF has ruled with an iron fist. They've opened up so many conversations and talks around the United States investing in natural resources within Ethiopia. And as we're seeing this kind of shift that China has had more of an influence in the Horn, it's definitely like a lot of a reason to believe that TPLF has become in prize for United States and for Europe to kind of come in and wreak havoc and chaos in Ethiopia until their buddies are back in power again. Dr. Abiy Ahmed, the current prime minister of Ethiopia, has made it very clear that he wants to have peace talks within the Horn and engage in political and economic integration cooperation. And that's just simply something that the West is not interested in, and that kind of ruins their unilateral influence. So that's really why they're backing the Tigray rebels in northern Ethiopia.
Ethiopia has also raised complaints about foreign support for TPLF, with a finger pointing at neighboring Sudan. There are also reports that Egypt might be backing these rebels. It is believed that Egypt and Sudan are backing TPLF rebels due to their differences with the current government in Addis Ababa over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam.
As we understand why they're interested in backing the Tigray rebels specifically, it's because they too have a stake in making sure that TPLF is back in power, or at least destabilizes Ethiopia in some way, specifically because we've seen conversations and arguments, really, back and forth between Egypt and Ethiopia as it relates to the Grand Renaissance Dam, the creation of that, how that goes into commodifying a natural resource like water in and of itself. And so the arguments about kind of who owns this resource and who gets what is really all being stoked by the West. And so because the West has such a great relationship with Egypt's leadership as well as Sudan, given the recent controversies and coup that happened in Sudan as well, this is all kind of part of this three-pronged plan for the U.S. to, again, make sure that it has that unilateral influence on the Horn.
Ethiopia has rejected a report by United Nations investigators that accused Addis Ababa of possible ongoing crimes against humanity in its war-torn Tigray region, including using starvation as a weapon. Ethiopia's permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva has categorically denounced the UN report.
The Commission has submitted a report of substandard quality. Its allegations are unsubstantiated and not meeting the standard of proof for such investigations. It has fallen prey to those well accustomed to deceiving bodies of this nature. This practice of targeting countries like Ethiopia ultimately undermines the authority and the credibility of the Human Rights Council. Without doubt, the report is selective and discriminatory, and its conclusions are politically motivated.
Now, after listening to the Ethiopian ambassador at the United Nations in Geneva, do you think Addis Ababa is justified in rejecting this UN report?
I think we have to be honest about what it means to be involved in a war and in a crisis, right? And so on both sides, there's definitely going to be killings. There's definitely has been mass suffering. So I think what's interesting about this particular report and why I definitely have reason to believe why the government really feels as though it's biased is because nowhere does it even talk about TPLF's crimes that it has committed. What's interesting is that they make it seem as though the Eritrean and Ethiopian government, as well as like local Amhara militias, are the reasons as to why this war has been waged, and that they're fighting against Tigray people and really attempting to quote unquote exterminate them, which is baseless because we're seeing extrajudicial killings all over the country, whether you are Oromo, Amhara.
The Ethiopian government and Tigrayan rebels failed to progress in peace talks, and renewed fighting broke out between the two sides late August. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said he was deeply shocked and saddened by the news of the resumption of hostilities in Ethiopia.
I am deeply shocked and saddened by the news of the resumption of hostilities in Ethiopia. Ethiopians, Tigrayans, Amharas, Oromos, Afars have already suffered too much.
The Western-backed TPLF rebels have been blamed for the deadlock in the Ethiopia peace process amid concern that many lives will be lost if the conflict continues.
It's really the Tigray authorities. TPLF is the main reason as to why we haven't really seen any progress with those peace talks. Because on June 14th, the Ethiopian government, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, had signaled this possibility that his government's going to hold peace talks with TPLF, to which TPLF had made it very clear in the media that they have rejected any of these talks at all. They said peaceful solution is not and has never been an option for Tigray.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, during a recent message to Ethiopians marking the Meskel holiday, said his government has done more than its share to ensure that the current conflict is resolved peacefully. Now, what in your opinion is the most practical roadmap for sustainable peace in Ethiopia?
So that really depends on one's definition of peace. I think for me, it is very clear that peace in the Horn, as it relates to Ethiopia as well, is political, economic cooperation and independence from the West, like in terms of their ties to NGOs and such. The only way that's going to happen is this support and cooperation from other neighboring countries of Ethiopia. So we're talking Eritrea, Somalia, and so many more. The only way that's really going to happen is one, TPLF has to be gone and dissolved. And I think that unity internally within Ethiopia is necessary as a pretext for working class unity across the Horn in general.
There you have it. Unity of all ethnic groups in Ethiopia is critical if sustainable peace is to be attained in this country. That's the opinion of Yolien Ogbum, an independent political writer and commentator. I would like to thank her for the incisive analysis. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the meddling by the European Union in the East African oil pipeline project. Stay with us.
Uganda slams EU meddling in its oil projects.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The European Union Parliament recently passed a resolution against the East African crude oil pipeline. EU legislators urged Total Energy, a French oil multinational, and its joint venture partners to delay the projects by 1 year to address environmental and human rights concerns.
Total Energies hopes to exploit the oil lying beneath Lake Albert in western Uganda. The East African crude oil pipeline is planned to be a 1,445-kilometer heated pipeline that will transport crude oil from Uganda to the coastal port of Tanga in Tanzania for onward shipment to the international market.
Members of Parliament in Uganda have criticized the European Union Parliament resolution, terming it blatant interference in the country's internal affairs. The Deputy Speaker of the Ugandan Parliament, Thomas Tayebwa, led his parliamentarians in rejecting the EU meddling in the country's oil pipeline project. Now, to discuss the European Union's meddling in the East African crude oil pipeline, we contacted Lawrence Freeman. He's an African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot for joining us today, sir.
My pleasure to be with you.
What is your take on this audacity by the EU Parliament to issue a resolution against the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline?
The Ugandan Parliament is correct that the European Union and the entire West has adopted this insane policy of a green reset, and it's being used to prevent the continued underdevelopment of Africa. Without energy development, which the African countries have a right to for their own to use their own resources for their own industrialization of their nation. And the European Union, along the United States, are insane on this question that the people are going to cause a burning up of the planet. I mean, not only is this not true, but to the Europeans themselves are buying gas and oil from Africa and from other countries. So it is beyond hypocritical. It's a continuation of the colonial, neocolonial policy to prevent African nations from fully developing their economic potential.
Uganda's Deputy Speaker of Parliament, Thomas Tayebwa, says the proposed pipeline only represents 0.5% of global emissions. Yet the EU, with just 10% of the world population, emits 20% unfettered, and member countries are exploring plans to deepen fossil fuel-related excavations unfettered. He added that the EU resolution represented the highest level of neocolonialism and imperialism against Uganda and Tanzanian sovereignty.
They're absolutely correct. The individual nations, nations trying to uplift the standard of living of their people, have a right and an actual obligation to use their resources for the development of the people. Africans across the continent, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, die every day because of the lack of electricity. And this is not an exaggeration. Lack of electricity, we don't have food production, we don't have food processing, we don't have energy to keep warm and to keep cold supplies, and therefore people are dying. And therefore it is colonialism, neocolonialism, imperialism, for the West to dictate to African countries. In fact, it may also be racism, that they cannot use their own resources for the development of their own nations, even though it's exactly what the West countries have done.
EU legislators have claimed that developing the East African crude oil pipeline will pose major environmental and climate risks. However, John Habumugisha, the Deputy Managing Director of the East African Crude Oil Pipeline, has given assurance to Ugandans that the project will have no adverse effect on the environment. Now, do you think EU countries really care about the environment? Yet the bloc is now allowing the use of coal, a major pollutant, to combat energy insecurity following the war in Ukraine?
Well, my view is that the climate change has been going on for billions of years since our planet was formed. And I don't consider the current changes in our climate and weather to be the result of human activity. So I don't buy into this whole propaganda that CO2 is the number one enemy of the world. In fact, plants and trees love CO2, and I don't think they would agree with human beings at all on this question. And therefore, the European countries, and of course they're buying oil and gas right now, even as they complain about it, they're buying it from Russia, they're buying it from other countries. There's not going to be any way of easily moving out coal, oil, and gas in the immediate future. And therefore, we should burn every pound of coal, oil, and gas we can to provide energy.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Uganda in July and met with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni, where they discussed the issue of rising fuel and food costs in Africa following Russia's military operation in Ukraine. The visit raised concerns in Europe and the United States. Is it likely that Russia's closeness to Uganda might be a contributing factor to EU's opposition to the East African crude oil pipeline?
It could well be. I can't say for sure, but we know that the West, in particular the United States, which is moving towards war with Russia and has already declared China its number one enemy, that the United States views the whole world from its insane, deranged geopolitical doctrine that they must remain on top and all other economic powers must be below them and follow their, quote, rules-based order, end of quote. So it's quite possible.
TotalEnergies has been warned by Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni that if its commitment to the country's $20 billion oil project begins to waver under pressure from the European Union, he will quickly find a new investor.
There is growing concern that the East African crude oil pipeline project might not take off, especially considering the fact that Uganda and Tanzania are relying on Western financial institutions to fund the project. However, Uganda and Tanzania are now considering other options to ensure the project moves forward.
Of course, the project should move forward. I mean, there's a lot of support that's coming from China in terms of long-term low-interest loans. There's loans that are also coming from India, Russia, Turkey, and a few other countries. But my approach is that these infrastructure projects, such as the one we're talking about, Uganda, Tanzania oil, and a whole bunch of other projects, water projects, energy projects, they all have to go ahead. And my view is, and I'm working with people to establish a Africa Infrastructure Development Bank that would actually provide long-term low-interest loans for exactly these kinds of infrastructure projects. Without energy, without infrastructure, without high-speed rail, Africa will not develop. It will not industrialize. I guarantee you that. And therefore, these projects must be fully supported, and the African countries have to organize themselves and mobilize themselves so that they can actually carry out the funding for these projects.
Tanzania's president, Samia Suluhu Hassan, says the East African Pipeline Project will, among other things, alleviate unemployment. Speaking during a visit to Uganda last year to witness the signing of the documents, she termed the event was an auspicious occasion that would unlock the development of the region's oil resources.
Apart from socioeconomic benefits, the project will also stimulate trade, investment, as well as unlocking the East Africa's oil potential, thus attracting more investors. More importantly, this project will strengthen strategic partnership and cooperation between our two brotherly countries, and in addition, it will forge further the regional integration and people's interaction.
Supporters of the East African Crude Oil Pipeline Project say it offers local and long-term solutions to economic challenges in the region and will therefore benefit the people. Now, do you agree with this perception?
Well, I think any time that you're producing energy for the population, that's a benefit. Pipeline energy is the most essential infrastructure that Africa, all nations need, and Africa has been deprived of it for hundreds of years. Rail development, high-speed rail, probably second. These kinds of projects are essential. They will lead to growth. They will lead to increasing the quality of life and standard of living of the people.
Well, our guest there says European Union's interference in the construction of the East African crude oil pipeline is tantamount to genocide because it prevents economic progress that is critical in preventing deaths related to poverty. I'd like to thank Lawrence Freeman, as always, for his time. That's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program, Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion, we have very special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Nur Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Okay, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, for today's discussion, we have another interesting topic and question, and that is the reward for paying visit or ziyara to the tomb of Imam al-Riza alayhi salam or Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. And it, according to some documents and references, it is equal, I mean, the reward of paying visit to Imam al-Riza or Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is equal to 1 million pilgrimages or Hajj pilgrimage. How is it possible that paying visit to the tomb of Imam will be considered as a reward of, for example, paying to the house of God, to the Kaaba, and to the Hajj pilgrimage? How is it possible?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know that in different narrations, we have the reward for the visitation of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salatu wassalam and for Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam. It has been said, according to a couple of narrations, it is, more than 1,000 pilgrimage to the Mecca, Hajj. And in some other narrations, 1 million times reward of the pilgrimage of Mecca and the going to Hajj. It actually has been specified for those people who go for the visitation of Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha alayhi salatu wassalam. Not only this visitation of these infallible Ahlul Bayt, but we have other recommended action has been, the reward of which has been multiplied to maybe more than 1,000 times or even more than 1,000 times. The very quick reply to this question is that the meaning of these kind of narrations is actually wanted to attract the people, attract the attention of people for going to the visitation. In other words, infallible Ahlul Bayt, they want to encourage people for going to the, visitation of Ahlul Bayt and the ziyara of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wasalam. Though, actually, according to some narrations, we have the visitation of Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha, as I mentioned. Yeah, this encouragement does not mean that they want to undermine the importance of recommended Umrah. No, it does not mean that. Rather, they want to encourage people for going to the visitation of these infallible Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam. Another quick reply to this question is that they want to attract the attention of people and the faithful people to the reality of Hajj and Umrah. You know that the reality of Hajj and Umrah is actually in the government, real Islamic government, which is the government of Ahlul Bayt, alayhim salatu wassalam, and the leadership and guardianship of Ahlul Bayt. For example, in one narration we have, Inna al-Imama Usul Islam An-Nami, which means that the basic fundamental of Islam and one of the most important bases of Islam is leadership and guardianship and actually imamat of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam. So by this great emphasis and encouragement for the visitation of Imam al-Hussein and different, multiplied reward for that, actually, they did not want to undermine the importance and priority of Umrah. Rather, they want to encourage people for going to the visitation of Ahlul Bayt. And in the other word, we can say that they want to invite people to the, real Hajj and Umrah, which is under the supervision and under the acceptance of the leadership of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wassalam. I need to explain these points. First of all, we have the one of the obligations of Islam is having pilgrimage to the, for this great worship of Hajj. Yes. This is very important and actually is one of the pillars of Islam, one of the great Islamic laws, that for those people who have all qualifications like financial capacity, physical capacity.
Yes.
They have to go to and have this pilgrimage to the Mecca.
Yes.
And to the house of Allah, Baytullah al-Haram. This is one of the obligations of Islam, and it has no addition to that and no replacement to that. Nobody can say, for example, when I go to Karbala or any other place, it's replaced that.
Yes.
No, no,
no.
It is granted, established that
yes.
you have to do that for mustati, for those people
yes.
who are qualified. They have to go and pay visit
yes.
to the house of Allah.
Yes.
It is granted.
So there is no replacement of, for example, the reward of paying visit to the holy tomb of Imam al-Hussein or going on Hajj pilgrimage.
Exactly.
It must not be any replacement. Okay.
No. In the in none of the Islamic obligations, we have this permission
yes.
to replace these Islamic obligations. تِلْكَ حُدُودُ اللَّهِ وَمَنْ يَتَعَدَّ حُدُودَ اللَّهِ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الظَّالِمُونَ.
That's right.
These are guidelines of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Nobody has right to change these laws of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's all right.
This is important and established idea because Islamic obligations, which we call it wajibat,
yes.
these are, we have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And these are pillars of Islamic laws. But why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala sometimes gives multitudes of reward if you visit, for example, the holy shrine of Imam Hussein,
yes.
alayhi salatu wa salam.
Yes. And maybe the number here is for, we can say, showing the emphasis, isn't it?
Exactly.
Okay. It is not exactly, the, for example, the quantity is 1,000 times or 1 million times.
Or, for example, 100 times.
It is not. For example, it shows the... we can say the importance and the significance of this action.
Exactly.
Okay.
This is very, accurate point that you mentioned. On the other hand, we have Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha alayhi wa sallam, they sacrificed whatever they had in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They sacrificed their life, property, and whatever belonging they have, even their soul, toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the blood, they
yes.
sacrificed the blood and
yes.
whatever they had in the way of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. وَبَدَلَ مُهْجَتَهُ فِيكِ Okay?
Yes.
Which means that he gave whatever he had and the blood of his heart toward Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
That's all right.
So it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala wanted to compensate their sacrifice with giving multitude of reward for visitation of the holy shrine of Imam al-Ridha
right.
or Imam al-Hussein alayhi
salatu yes,
wasalam.
Right.
So, okay?
Yes.
I want to say that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, out of his mercy,
mm-hmm.
he wanted to give and shower
mm-hmm.
the visitors of Imam al-Ridha or Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam with multitude of mercy for the respect of the dignity of these infallible Imam,
right.
Imam al-Hussein and Imam al-Ridha, for example.
Okay.
And he wanted to compensate and make up their sacrifice
yes.
with giving a lot of reward for the visitors of these Imams.
That's
okay?
right.
Or whatever, for example, visitation, or for example, reciting the Arad Ashura,
yes.
or whatever related to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
That's right.
So,
and usually the quality is important because some people have, how can I say, a kind of mathematical mind in order to number the sawab that they take. Okay, for example, I had one pilgrimage to Imam al-Hussein or Imam al-Reza, so it is 1,000, for example, 1 million Hajj pilgrimage. And mathematically speaking, they are counting, for example, the rewards. This is not right, okay? Maybe you take your visit to Imam al-Hussein or Imam al-Reza, but your visit or your ziyarah was not qualified enough.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes. Oh, for example, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you this kind of reward
yes.
for the sake of the, respecting the dignity
yes.
of the and the position, high position
yes,
of
yes.
these infallible imams.
That's right.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio.
You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So it does not mean that you can replace, for example, Hajj yes. with this idea. This is kind of funny.
Or, for example, you leave some of your obligations or wajibat, for example, your salat, your psalm, you know, your fasting and your prayer, and then you say, okay, I go and visit an Imam al